We have several visitors. We're grateful for your presence. You are our honored guests, but we are all honored guests of God and of Christ, even this moment as we're all assembled together to worship Him, sing praises, and to encourage each other. If we leave here stronger than we walked in, then we'll have accomplished what we need to do. We're thankful to God for His grace and His mercy and His patience with us as we all learn and grow. If you have a device of mass distraction, please turn it down or turn it off or whatever you have to do so it doesn't distract us. We have enough distractions in the world. We don't need one more, especially right now.
This is going to be a brief noise for
my... Okay. I'm glad to get the distraction out of the way. Rather now than later. Okay. So, for those of you who have been here, you know that we've been studying from Daniel 7 and Daniel 2 and Revelation 13 or Revelation 17. This is our fourth study along those lines. We're going to begin with a little history. The Roman kingdom established around 753 BC, a city-state. In other words, just a little city. There it is. There's Rome. That little dot there, you can see it very well. There's Rome. There's the kingdom set on seven hills. The government was a king who was chosen by a senate. The senate then would not have as much power as the king did. This kingdom lasted until 509 BC. And I had to cut lots and lots of history because it's irrelevant. What's important at 509 BC is that the government changed. And it changed from a king to two consuls who were elected annually by the citizens, advised by a senate comprising elected magistrates. So from a king to two consuls, a little bit of a different government setup. That's what's important for us. Now, this kingdom is going to last until 27 BC, hundreds of years. It starts off, you know, a little bit bigger than the city-state was. But by the end of 27 BC, it'll be this big, huge. A lot can happen in 500 years, 400 years. A little bit about how this republic ended. You might remember a guy named Julius Caesar. Caesar is a name that will later on be a title. He crosses the Rubicon, somewhere up there. He used to own all of up there, not own, but he was the governor of up there, and then he came down, and he crossed, and once he crosses the Rubicon, that was treason to do that, at the head of an army. So he attacks this man named Pompey. In 48 BC, Julius Caesar is appointed dictator. Now, a dictator is actually an official position. It's a military position. They had more authority than the two consuls, and so it was only for 6 months. That's the term. Look, we've got a problem in the kingdom. We need a dictator for 6 months, and so they appoint a dictator. Well, in 46 BC, Julius Caesar is appointed a dictator for 10 years. And then in 44 BC, he's appointed a dictator for life. A little bit of a difference there from 6 months to life. Meanwhile, he's also appointing himself as consul, or one of the consuls. He had so much power that, remember, there's two consuls, but 1 year he had so much power and the other one exercised so little power that they called it the year of the consul of Julius and Caesar. In the 15th of March, the Ides of March, which is just a month after he is appointed dictator for life, he is assassinated. His adopted son, then, Julius Gaius Caesar Octavianus, becomes Julius Caesar's adopted son and political heir. Actually, after he dies, it's in his will, I want this relative to become my son, my adopted son. So this guy, Octavian, is what we call him. The Roman Senate grants him even more power. Now, understand, this is huge. So what was going on here, a government headed by two consuls and magistrates in the Senate, is now basically being transferred into this one man. That's essentially what's going on. It's not that quick, but that's what's happening. Octavian then adopts the titles Augustus and Imperator. Augustus, it means the illustrious one. It's actually a religious term. And basically when he did that, he took to himself powers and authorities that were nowhere in the Constitution. And so again, he's centralizing power and concentrating power in himself or in his position. He also takes on the term Imperator, which was given to generals. Caesar was one, Julius Caesar, this happened all the time. But he now takes this term and gives it to himself. He's the ruler, the supreme ruler of all the military, and he won't give this title to anybody else. So he's the only one. All right. This is a big difference from what had been. In fact, this difference is huge. And it is generally accepted, 27 AD. Now, you'll find differences, but generally speaking, you'll also find this a lot every time you do some research. It is generally accepted as the beginning of the Roman Empire. You know, the empire, the kingdom that is in existence during the events of the New Testament. This is the kingdom that is in power. Now, you might say, what's the difference between the kingdom and then the republic and then the empire? Well, in some ways there's no difference, in some ways it's a huge difference. But essentially the difference, initially, is just the government. We say that our country was founded in 1776. We don't go back to 1492 when they started coming over. We don't come back to when they started to start the colonies in 1603, I think that was. And then later on, when they had the Continental Congress in 1774, I think that was. We don't go back to them. However, the framework was there. It's the same people, it's the same place, but a change of government, somewhat like with the European Union. Same people, same countries, but boom, new government. Okay, for the Roman Empire. Now, this is very important for our study. The Roman Empire. This is the beast of Daniel 7 and Revelation. This is what we've talked about these last few weeks. It's an autocratic form of government. In other words, they rule themselves. They're not ruled by the people. Okay? And it's headed by an emperor. It will last until 476 AD, and the eastern part will last a little longer, but as a whole, will last till 476 AD. Very important to remember, the first two centuries of the empire's existence were mostly a period of unprecedented political stability and prosperity known as Roman peace. Okay, when Augustus becomes emperor, what he'll do is he'll expand the territory of the government a little bit. And not only that, but for the next 200 years, everything's going pretty much gung-ho. All right. Emperor number one, Augustus Caesar. Luke mentions Augustus in Luke chapter 2, verse 1. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census be taken. It's just interesting to note that Augustus is mentioned. He will be followed by Tiberius Caesar, a relative of both Julius and a relative of Augustus. He will reign from 14 to 37. In Luke 3, he is mentioned, Tiberius Caesar. He is the Caesar that is ruling when Jesus is put to death. Then there's Caligula Caesar, who didn't reign very long, three plus years. Nothing really of note for us that we'll mention here. Then Claudius Caesar, Luke mentions him in Acts 18, verse 1. Actually, it's verse 2. He found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. Now, we know from Suetonius that this is the emperor who sent them. Who else would send them out of Rome? Something else happens at this time. The empire expands up into what we would call Britain. And it gets up there. And it goes down into Egypt. And it's going everywhere. The point is, the empire is not slowing down. It's getting bigger. If you're back there, you're still, oh yes, if you're a nationalist, you're excited about the growth of your country at this time. Nero, probably everybody in here has heard of Nero, would come next. Acts 25:11. He is not mentioned by name, but Paul, when he says, I appeal to Caesar, is appealing to Nero. We know that Because in verse 27 of chapter 24, after 2 years passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. Nero is the one we know from secular history that called, said, Felix, you get back here, we've got to talk to you. Now, Nero is very interesting for us and noteworthy for us because he is the first to persecute Christians. We'll talk about this just for a minute. Peter and Paul, according to tradition, were martyred under Nero. Later in Nero's term. Christians, during this persecution, were beheaded. Paul, according to tradition, because he was a Roman citizen, was beheaded. They were crucified. Peter, because he was not a Roman citizen, according to tradition, probably true, was crucified upside down. Because Peter said, I don't want to be crucified in the same way my Lord was. Jesus was crucified head up. So Peter said, I want to be crucified head down. Probably true, don't know. Some Christians were bound to raging bulls and dragged to death. Now, actually, I have not been able to verify that. I've seen that in a statement, but I've not been able to verify it with an ancient source. I suspect it's true, but I haven't verified it. So if somebody came in and said, that's not true, I'd have to say, okay. But the others are. It is said of Caesar, Nero, Tacitus, a Roman historian, writes that he was incredibilium cupitor. You recognize Cupid, and you recognize incredible. He loved to push the envelope. He was a master at inventing new ways to torture people. In fact, Christians were sewed up in skins of wild beasts and exposed to the dogs in the arena. Sew them up, and you know what a dog does to a dead carcass with a Christian inside. Christians were covered with pigeon oil, nailed to posts, and lighted while Nero raced. So he had this chariot race that he would ride around in, and he'd ride all by himself, and he'd ride with others. And the Christians, he'd do this at nighttime. And what was lighting was not street lamps, but Christians who were on the posts burning. Juvenal writes about Christians, thou too, about other Christians, thou too shalt shine like those we saw, stand at the stake with throat transfixed, smoking and burning. This was the persecution that was going on during Nero's time. Now we have to note, Nero persecuted Christians only as a personal expedient, not for being Christians. They were Christians, and he found Christians, but it's not because they were Christians that he persecuted them. Let me illustrate it this way, first of all. Okay, over there in Somalia, if there's a boat going by and it has an American flag, the Somalian is going to go out there and get that boat. Not necessarily because he hates Americans, but because he knows there's money on that boat. However, if a Muslim in Somalia sees that boat, a radical extremist, terrorist, conservative, if he sees that boat, he's going to get that boat for a totally different reason, because they are Americans. Okay, same thing with Nero. Nero wasn't going after Christians because they're Christians, but he was going after them because, well, see, the city had burned, and according to Tacitus, Tacitus said Nero needed an excuse because some people think that Nero actually started it. Whether or not he started it, he needed to put the finger on somebody because that's what politicians do. And so he found the Christians who everybody was starting to hate then, and he said, you guys did it, and so he started persecuting them. So it was not, it wasn't an empire-wide empire policy. Okay. Another thing to note is that Nero's persecution was confined to the city of Rome according to the Roman historians. Now, there might have been other Christians persecuted during this time, but Nero's persecution, according to the Roman historians, was confined only to Rome. And it only lasted a few months. So he persecutes the Christians, but it's limited, local, unofficial, and just an expedient. Now, something else. Rumors of Nero not really being dead. Nero committed suicide. He murdered two of his wives, a couple of his brothers, he murdered some other people, and then he killed himself. All right, so he commits suicide. But at that time, there was a rumor going around that Nero wasn't dead, but in reality, he had gone to Parthia, and was going to come back and destroy Rome. So at that time, he was dead, but he wasn't really dead. Remember that for later. This brings us to the next three. There's Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, who reign just like that. You'll notice there's only a year and a half, June 68, December 69. Year and a half for the three of them. During their time, Caesar, the family of Caesar, all these are actually related to Julius Caesar. But afterwards, we won't. The line of Caesar is now dead. Also, there are civil wars, and these are usurpers. They keep on killing each other to get into power. Year and a half, or months. Just a couple months. And all they're doing this time is just trying to retain power. That's the only contribution they have to the empire. At the same time, you might remember that the rebellion in Judea is going on. Okay? So during this time, chaos. In fact, remember I said there was 200 years of peace and prosperity, except for right now. Now, there was also other unpeaceful events, but this is the biggest one. Everybody looks at this and say, there was chaos at that time. So Vespasian comes back from Judea. He leaves his son there, who will destroy Jerusalem in AD 70, but that's not important for our discussion today. Vespasian comes back, and he is looked at as the restorer of the empire to stability. He does not persecute Christians, not as an empire-wide policy to persecute Christians. We don't read of it in history. Now, we've gone from looking at people who do to now we're looking at people who do not. It's noteworthy that they do not persecute Christians. His son will reign after him, Titus. He is the shortest reign of any besides the usurpers. Okay, besides those, Titus has the shortest reign of any of the emperors. He does not persecute Christians. No empire policy to persecute Christians. After him comes a man named Domitian. Domitian stands out. Several things about him. First of all, he is set apart from his youth as a braggart. Suetonius writes, Suetonius did a history of the 12 Caesars. Okay, remember Julius Caesar? He includes Julius Caesar in the Caesars, and he ends with Domitian. So if you count Julius Caesar and you go to Domitian, you have 12. So he does, this is what we're talking about. Suetonius is a Roman historian. What he says is, from his youth, he was far from being an affable disposition, but was on the contrary presumptuous and unbridled both in act and in word. Suetonius, if you had to find one emperor who was more arrogant than the others, who would you point to? And he'd say, Domitian. Important for us to know. Domitian also made claims of personal deity. This had gone on a little bit through time, but now it's getting real. Suetonius, with no less arrogance, he began as follows in issuing a circular letter in the name of his procurators. So he would write a letter that he would send out in their name, but he had actually written it. And what he writes is, our master and our God bids that this or that be done. He's talking about himself. And so the custom arose henceforth of addressing him in no other way, even in writing or conversation. When he walks in the room, guess what you say? Master or God. When he walked into the theater, they were all urged to rise and shout, all hail to our Lord and his lady. And the way they use Lord is the way we would use Lord. We're not saying master. We're saying when we use the word Lord, we're talking about deity. They would too. And also, he began a long, it would begin 200 years of on and off, empire-wide official policy of persecuting the Christians for being Christians. Remember, you address him as our Lord and Master. Do it. Well, who's not going to? A Christian isn't. And so how does he look at them? Remember, we quoted this last week, hate and persecute those who try to bring in false religions. What's a Christian doing? Running around trying to bring in a true religion. Persecuting the Christians, in fact, not only was it long and empire-wide and official policy, but it was also extremely gruesome. We don't have very much information on it other than what some people have written. Tacitus, again a Roman historian, writes that Domitian was a charlatan masquerading as Nero. That gives you the idea of what kind of tortures Domitian was bringing in against these Christians. Okay, there is some history. Not much, but a little bit. What I want to do now is compare Daniel chapter 7 with this history. So go ahead and turn to Daniel 7. We have been studying from Daniel 7, and so I'm not going to go over all of it. I'll just say that the assertion that I have been making, and that is relatively clear, and that many, even dispensational millennialists, also will say, oh, the beast is talking about, initially talking about Rome. So we're talking about Rome here. Daniel 7, verse 7. After this, I kept looking in the night visions. Behold, a fourth beast, Rome. Dreadful, terrifying, extremely strong. It had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled all the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. Oh, 10 horns. Remember this. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little horn, came in among them. Three of the first horns were pulled up by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. So you have 10 plus 1 horns. Now, we looked last week and we said, oh, the 10 plus 1 horns, they're kings. We understand that from Revelation 13 and Revelation 17. And we're not the only ones that say that. Others say that as well. Verse 19, I decided to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, so he has it explained to him. Verse 20, and he wants to know the meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn, 10 plus 1 is 11. 11, the other horn which came up, and before which three of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, which was larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them. Verse 23, thus the explainer, the interpreter, says, the fourth beast is a fourth kingdom. We talked about that. That's Rome. Verse 24. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, and another will arise after them. So you have 10 plus 1, an 11th king. Now, we have seen already in Daniel chapter 7 that this king is uttering great boasts. Several times it says he's uttering great boasts. Huh, we have a braggart here. Just keep that in mind. He makes claims of personal deity. This guy does, Domitian. Look in verse 25. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and he will intend to make alterations in times and in law. Keep your finger there. Turn to Daniel 2. In Daniel 2, there's another mystery, but I want us to read one part. Verse 19. The mystery was revealed to Daniel in the night vision. Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Who? Daniel says about the God of heaven. Daniel said, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever. For wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. You see that? That's God's role. So back here in chapter 7, we have this guy trying to do God's work. What does it say? That he'll speak out against the Most High. Right. A claim of a personal deity is pretty much speaking out against... This guy here is saying, I'm God, and you call me God. And God's saying, no, I'm God, and you call me God. And then, he is the one that is wearing down the saints. This one is the one. Remember, there's 10 plus 1 horns. And remember, from last week, we see there's the 10, but God is calling attention. He's saying, I want you to look at not only the 10, but this one. Look at this one. Here, the 10th plus 1, the 11th horn, is wearing down the saints. He's the one. Oh, we have that right here. And you've heard me say it several times. Which horn? Not the 10th, but the 11th. This is what we call plug and play. Now, this is not an inspired interpretation. More about that in a minute. But when you look at Daniel chapter 7, and you look at history, although nowhere in the Bible is the word Domitian mentioned, you put these two together and you say, huh. Last week we said, who is this horn? And some people said, it's the Antichrist of a future time. And we said, no, that doesn't work. Here are some problems with that. Logical, biblical, reasonable problems with that. Here now we're saying, hey, wait a minute. Let's try to figure out who it is. And then we look at history and we compare it with the Bible. And these things go just like that. I'm suggesting, somewhat strongly, only somewhat, that Daniel 7 is talking about Domitian. That was the easy one. Let's turn to Revelation 17. Revelation 17, verse 8. The beast you saw was, is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction. Again, we've looked at Daniel 7, Daniel 2, Revelation 13, and Revelation 17, and we have said, and others also say, these are all talking about the same beast. In other words, the Roman kingdom. Or I should say, the Roman Empire, but to use the biblical term, the Roman kingdom. All right. And those who dwell on the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will wonder when they see the beast that he was and is not and will come. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. We talked about all this last week. Get me for the notes if you want to. And these seven heads are seven kings. Five have fallen. One is. The other has not yet come. When he comes, he must remain a little while. The beast, which is not, is himself also an eighth, and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. All right, how does that fit? Can we make it fit? And I use the word make it as though we have to, but is it reasonable is the question. All right, let me suggest this. Seven plus one kings. Verse 10, seven kings. Verse 11, an eighth king. I wasn't homeschooled. Seven plus one is eight, right? The seven plus one kings. I suggest that the plus one is a device for calling attention to the one. Daniel, you had a 10 plus one. Now look at this one. In Revelation, you have seven plus one. Now look at this one. I'm suggesting that it's a device, a literary device, God is using through John and through Daniel to say, I want you to look at this one specific king. All right. I suggest the plus one king of Revelation 17 is the same as the plus one king of Daniel 7, Emperor Domitian. All right? I suggest that the 7 plus 8 plus 1 equals 8 of kings of Revelation 17 is the same as the 11 minus 3 equals 8 kings of Daniel. Remember, we briefly noticed this last week. In Daniel, you've got 11, but 3 of them are uprooted. Remember, 11 minus 3 is 8. Here, you have 7 plus 1 is 8. All right. I'm asserting that this is a device. The minus 3 would be these three, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, because they didn't really contribute anything to the government or to the empire. They were just trying to survive, and they died, some of them within months of each other. Okay? The answer would be what Daniel uproots, John simply ignores. Now, this is an assertion that I'm making. Is it more than an assertion? Is there any strength to it? I think there is. It's reasonable. God does this with language. God does this with pictures. In fact, I'm not the only one that makes this assertion. Philip Schaff, the historian, who is also a dispensationalist, he says, the station may therefore be regarded as the sixth head, the three brevels not being counted. In fact, Suetonius himself doesn't really even, in his 12 Caesars, he doesn't allot much space to Otho, Galba, and Vitellius. Why not? Well, because there wasn't much to talk about them. Okay. Let me speculate a little bit more. I suggest that of the seven kings, verse 10, there are seven kings. Five have fallen. Okay, who would those five be? Those five would be Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and Nero, leaving one is. Okay, now, one would be Galba, except for, if this theory is right, then Galba, Otho, and Vitellius aren't included, which leaves Vespasian. That line shouldn't be down there, but Vespasian would be the one who is. Okay, who then is next? The other has not yet come. Well, who would that be? Well, who's next? Titus would be next. Notice, when he comes, he must remain a little while. Now, discounting those three up there, Titus reigned the shortest of them all. Does that fit? Yeah, it fits. Okay? We'll go on. I suggest that the eighth king, then, is Domitian. one of the seven kings. Notice it says in verse 11, the beast, which was and is not, is himself also an eighth, and is one of the seven. What does that mean? Well, I'm suggesting that one of the seven means he is like Nero. Nero was the only, Domitian was the only one who was like Nero. Remember, what did Nero do? He persecuted the Christians. The others didn't until Domitian comes along. Tacitus in his histories speaks of Domitian as a charlatan masquerading as Nero. That's a Roman empire, Roman historian, not somebody with an agenda here trying to figure out Revelation. He said, look, these two are similar. Tertullian, who was a Christian apologist, or so-called Christian at least, he says, consult your annals. There you will find Nero, the first emperor who dyed his sword in the blood. I wonder who the second one would be. Well, for him, we go to Eusebius, the second, and he's talking about Domitian, he's the second to promote persecution against us. And you'll notice that he says he himself showed himself the successor of Nero's campaign. So they're writing back then, here's Nero, look what Nero did, and then here's Domitian. Domitian did it too. In fact, he is the successor of Nero. So the eighth king would be Domitian. One of the seven would be Domitian is Nero, or like him. Tertullian writes, or refers to Domitian as a bloody limb, a limb of the bloody Nero. He's part of Nero, is what Tertullian writes way back then. So I'm not the only fruitcake that comes up with this interpretation. Another reason that Nero, Domitian might be Nero, quote unquote, is there's Nero Redivivus. You get out of that revived. Nero revived. Remember, Nero was dead, but he wasn't dead. Okay, that was a Roman, pagan rumor that was floating around. He's not really dead. He's all over there in Parthia. Well, it's morphed now. Now, he hasn't come back yet, but he actually did die, but he's going to come back to life. This is pagan. A common belief was that Nero was going to come back from the dead. Tacitus, a Roman historian, writes about Domitian, who we're talking about right now, that when you said Nero to Domitian, he would tremble. Why? Because Domitian thought Nero was coming back. And I'm suggesting that Nero did come back as Domitian. Look, Nero is the one that's persecuting. He doesn't, he doesn't, he doesn't, he doesn't, he doesn't. Oh, here he is. The next time you have this kind of persecution is under Domitian. All right, that is a suggestion. That is your speculation, my speculation. I suggest then that the was is not. Look at verse 8. The beast you saw that was and is not and is about to come up. Verse 11, the beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth. Okay, so was, is not, will be. Well, how does all this work then? Remember we said last week that if you have a kingdom, then you have a king. And if you have a king, then you have a kingdom. And I know it says the beast is not, but in verse 10 it says there is a king. So how can you reconcile these two? I'm suggesting that it's not saying that the entire kingdom is gone. Rather, I'm suggesting that it's saying some characteristic of the kingdom is gone. When this is being written, some characteristic of, in the vision, some characteristic of the kingdom exists, there's a king. But some characteristic of the kingdom does not exist. Well, what would that be? Well, Nero's persecution was, right now it is not. This king who is Vespasian. The eighth king in Revelation, or the 11th king in Daniel, is Domitian. But the king that is right now is Vespasian. There's no persecution. There won't be. Five have fallen. One is. The other has not yet come. No persecution. No persecution. Verse 11, here comes the persecution again. Would be Domitian's persecution. All right. There's a mouthful there. I don't expect everybody to get that. You can have the notes if you want them for what they're worth, which I'm telling you is not much. That is my speculation. If somebody says, hey Lee, tell me, who do you think the little horn is? Well, there you've heard it. You didn't ask, but I figured I'd give it to you anyway. I'm not the only one that asserts this. In fact, some dispensational premillennialists, chapter 13, go ahead and turn there. verse 2, the beast I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like a bear. His mouth was like a lion. The dragon gave him power. Verse 3, I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. They worshipped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who is able to wage war against him? You see, because according to my thoughts, right during this time, it looked like Rome was down and out. But guess what happened? They came back. That's what I'm suggesting, and I'm not the only one that does. The ESV Study Bible, some of you have, leans towards dispensationalism. Rome, on Revelation 13, Rome, the manifestation of the beast in John's day, seemed to have been mortally wounded by Nero's suicide and the civil chaos that followed, but experienced a resurrection in the reigns of Vespasian and his sons Titus and Domitian. Then, in Domitian's reign, AD 81 to 96, Nero's beastly persecution of the church was also revived. So, you've heard it from me. That's what I think is the case. You go home and take it for what it's worth. You study on your own. Tell me what you come up with. But I'm not the only one that thinks this. In fact, some of the dispensationalists think this. In fact, if you take all of them, you'll get bits and pieces of the truth. And if you just took it all and put it together and say, here, this is what all of you are saying. This is the truth. Now get rid of the rest of it. You could actually do that. Now, if you could convince one of them. All right. We have speculated. And we have speculated, and we have speculated. And you know my opinion about speculating, especially from this platform. So we're going to talk about that for just a second. You are what you eat. The question is this. Who in here would actually eat only donuts and ice cream? I mean, it sounds like fun. Who? Anybody here not like donuts and ice cream or something? You know? Chocolate fondue? Woo! Give it to me. I want it. Who here would actually eat only those things? Not one of us. Not one of us. We know we would not. Why not? Because you know it would kill you. It would leave you vulnerable if it didn't kill you. The bigger picture is this dye typo that I decided to leave in there because that's what would happen, would badly affect your body. This diet, it should be. This diet, you'd fall, you'd die. In my last four sermons, which have been on this, Greg spoke once, but in my last four sermons, Daniel 7, we have incrementally stepped away from forced interpretations. I don't know if you've been paying attention. You need to be. Forced interpretations and conclusions and further into the realm of, this could be, who is it? So, Daniel 7, we read the text and we made some points that can be made from Daniel 7 and from other places. The next lesson was, well, who is the beast? And you know what? Acts 2 with Joel 2 and Daniel 2 and Isaiah 2 in history, and everybody agrees, oh, it's not explicit. And so, it's not even necessarily implied, but it is in there. Nobody misses it. So we took a little step away from what's forced. And then the next week, last week we said, who isn't the king? This little horn. And we said, it's definitely not the Antichrist. Actually, we didn't even say it's definitely not. We said, you know, the Antichrist doesn't really plug in there. That doesn't really work. You know, it could be true, but not from what we saw. And this week, we're looking at the little horn, and you heard how many times I said, may I suggest, I'm guessing this is my best guess. So we walked away from, look, you can put your finger right there, there it is. We walked away to, maybe, a steadier diet of that. Oh, by the way, note well that it was very sensational. Ooh, fun. Oh, I like to read this stuff and try to figure out, oh, is it this person? Oh, a whole bunch of history. Oh, it could be that. Ooh, guess what I have to put on Facebook this week? All right. Spiritually speaking, if we spend all our time on speculation and sensationalism, we'd never be equipped to ward off the devil's arrows. We never would be. Just like eating donuts and ice cream. That's not good for the body. You've got a shield with holes in it. Arrow comes through and kills you. That theory, Satan comes up to you and says, that theory has some holes in it. That won't do you any good in battle. Who here wants to go out to battle with 1/8 inch thick poplar wood shield. If you know what that means, you're laughing. Because you don't. It's softwood. It would be cut right through. Well, here's this theory. There's not much under that belief, is there? If this is all we ever spent our time on, it would be fluff. Oh, but it sure was fun. It fed my insatiable itch to talk about things that are sensational and fun, but it wouldn't do anything for us. I know that because the Bible is not cover to cover Revelation. God gives us what we need, and He didn't give us 750,000 words of Revelation. That's not what He did. In fact, turn to 1 John or 2 John. Second John 5, I ask you, lady, not as though I were commanding a new commandment, but one which we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. And this is love, that we sit down and read Daniel 7 and Ezekiel and Revelation and just pore over that and take guesses all day long of what it could possibly be. Because you'll never know, because I haven't told you. No. Walk according to His... This is love. Walk according to His commandments. Chapter 5, 1 John 5. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. Whoever loves the Father loves the child of born of Him. But we know by this, we know that we love the children of God when we read Revelation and speculate all day long. When we love God and observe His commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments. That's where the meat is. You know, like pray often. You know, this gets into my time. I've got things to do that I want to do. You mean I've got to pray often? That's a commandment. 1 Thessalonians. Here's another one. Surround yourself with godly friends. Oh, that's not easy to hear. Not necessarily. It ought to be easy to hear. Obey the government? Oh, man. Especially as our government gets crazier and crazier? Yes. As long as it's not telling you to sin, obey the government. I mean, you're cramping my style here. But this is the stuff that helps us to grow in our love toward each other and to God. Go to... Oh, no. Really? Yeah. You know, when the church assembles, we ought to be here. Why? Because we're trying to help each other grow in our love. That is the context of Hebrews. Hard to hear, but that's what it says. Exercise self... Oh, let's skip over that one. I don't want to talk about that one. Give your... No, let's not talk about that one either. And don't use music... Oh, this one's an easier one to... You know, for some of us, it's easier. Don't use... Yeah, okay. Now, this is a command. But, you know, some of us... I want to. Why can't I? Well, God says not to. And this is the kind of thing that will increase your love for your brethren and for God. Not studying... Well, studying Revelation will, but not speculating about all this and this and everything else, etc., etc., etc. These commands. So here's a point to be made. If I find studying and keeping God's commandments to be mundane, boring, and simplistic, it's a red flag. There's a litmus test. You come into church. Oh, man, church again. Yes. My wife does an excellent job of correcting everybody in the house, including me. She says, I got to go to church. You mean we get to? Yes. It's a great... Right. And I don't really mean, oh, we've got to go to church. But if that were my attitude... If I am addicted to sensational speculating... Remember, we live in the world of extreme. Do you know that there's a drink out there with a monster claw in it? It's a beverage, folks. Polar vortex. Ooh! Folks, it's the Bible. Go to church. Pray. Do what's right. Not this speculation, sensationalism. Too much ice cream and too many donuts will kill you. If you're addicted to this stuff, that's a red flag also. Be very careful. This is not saying don't ever talk about it. Steady diet is what we're talking about. And one last point quickly. God will make you eat your words. The scene in Revelation, the whole scene in Revelation is worship the beast or else. Remember that in Revelation 13? They're all saying, they're amazed. Look at Him who has the power. He's been resurrected from the dead. We can worship the beast. And the point is, Caesar's coming around and saying, yeah, you better worship me, Christian, or else. The point of the whole scene in Revelation is that beast, which is putting you in this situation, is going to die. That beast will die. Revelation 17, verse 11. Remember, it's gone, it was, it is, not, it will be. And when he comes up, he'll persecute for you for a little while, and then he will go away to destruction. Revelation 19, the beast was seized, verse 20, within the false prophet who performed signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. And he was thrown in the lake. That is the point of Revelation. Well, we're speculating about what's this and what's this. Don't miss the point. The picture is worship. Worship the beast or else. The point is, don't worship the beast because he's going to die. And when he dies, what's left? God. And you will have to answer to him. You said that I was your master, and then you went and said that he's your master. He's not your master. I am always your master, and I will make you eat those words for eternity. So the principle that we need to get, the big picture, is this principle that's talked about in Revelation applies in every aspect of our lives. Romans 6 and verse 16. This is the last verse. Romans 6 in verse 16. Do you not know that when you present yourselves to someone as slaves for obedience, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin resulting in death or of obedience resulting in... right. See, the, it's simple, folks. It's so simple. There's nothing... Oh, it's gray. No, it ain't. God is the master, and we have said, you're my master. And every time we choose sin, do you know what we're saying? No, sin is my master. But you've already said God is your master. Now you're saying sin is your master? Who is your master? God. And in the end, every single person here will recognize that God is the master. And if you say he's not right now, he will make you eat those words. And that's to put it lightly, isn't it? That's the whole picture of Revelation. That's life. Remember, he is your master. He always will be. You can acknowledge it now consistently, or you will acknowledge it later. It's your choice. The place to become a servant of the Lord's is in baptism. Chapter 6, verse 1. What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin so that grace may increase? May it never be. How shall we who died to sin still live in it? Or do you not know that all of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus have been baptized into his death? And you read the rest of the context there. Have you been baptized for the remission of sins? If you have been, and then you've slipped back into sin, read the book of Revelation. And look what happens to the bad people. And you're right in there. If you have not been baptized for remission of your sins, then you need to be. You read the book of Revelation too. Quick personal story for you. Until I was a Christian, which was January 10th, 1998, for the last 4 years before I was a Christian, every year at midnight on January 1st, I don't know why, I looked at the door because I was convinced that Jesus was going to come through the door and get me. What a fool I was. Because I knew what I was supposed to do, but I didn't do it for 4 long years at least, if not more. Don't be in that same situation. Jesus is coming. You will bow to him. Choose to do that now. If we can help you in any way, let us know as we stand and sing the song that's been chosen.